three-dimensional and detailed, of a fairy world. It was a prettily grotesque place, set inside what might have been a forest glade surrounded by what appeared to be flowering toadstools, and drifting down through the air, as if it might have been a part of the air itself, came what looked for all the world like a shower of jeweled snow, sparkling and glinting in the violet light of a great blue sun. There were things dancing in the glade, and they looked more like flowers than animals, but they moved with a grace and poetry that fired one's blood to watch. Then the fairy place was wiped out, and there was another place, a wild and dismal place, with grim, gaunt, beetling cliffs rearing high against a red and angry sky, while great flying things that looked like flapping dish rags beat their way up and down the cliffs, and there were others of them roosting, most obscenely, upon the scraggly projections that must have been some sort of misshapen trees growing from the very wall of rock. And from far below, from some distance that one could only guess, came the lonesome thundering of a rushing river. He put the cube back upon the table. He wondered what it was that one saw within its depths. It was like turning the pages of a book, with each page a picture of a different place, but never anything to tell where that place might be. When he first had been given it, he had spent fascinated hours watching the pictures change as he held it in his hands. There had never been a picture that looked even faintly like any other picture, and there was no end to them. One got the feeling that these were not pictures, actually, but that one was looking at the scene itself, and that at any moment one might lose his perch upon whatever he was roosting and plunge head first down into the place itself. But it had finally palled upon him, for it had been a senseless business, gawking at a long series of places that had no identity. Senseless to him, of course, he thought, but not senseless, certainly, to that native of Enif V who had given it to him. It might, for all he knew, Enoch told himself, be of great significance and a treasure of great value. That was the way it was with so many of the things he had. Even the ones that had given pleasure, he knew, he might be using wrongly, or at least in a way that had not been intended. But there were some, a few, perhaps, that did have a value he could understand and appreciate, although in many instances their functions were of little use to him. There was the tiny clock that gave the local times for all the sectors of the galaxy. And while it might be intriguing, and even essential under certain circumstances, it had little value to him. And there was the perfume mixer, which was as close as he could come in naming it, which allowed a person to create the specific scent desired. Just get the mixture that one wanted and turn it on, and the room took on that scent until one should turn it off. He'd had some fun with it, remembering that bitter winter day when, after long experimenting, he had achieved the scent of apple blossoms and had lived a day in spring while a blizzard howled outside. He reached out and picked up another piece, a beautiful thing that always had intrigued him, but for which he had never found a use, if, indeed, it had a use. It might be, he told himself, no more than a piece of art, a pretty thing that was meant to look at only. But it had a certain feel, if that were the word, which had led him to believe it might have some specific function. It was a pyramid of spheres, succeeding smaller spheres set on larger spheres. Some 14 inches tall, it was a graceful piece, with each of the spheres a different color, and not just a color painted on, but each color so deep and true that one knew instinctively the color was intrinsic to each sphere, that the entire sphere, from the center of it out to the surface, was all of its particular color. There was nothing to indicate that any glue-like medium had been used to mount the spheres and hold them in their places. It looked for all the world as if someone had simply piled the spheres, one atop the other, and they had stayed that way. Holding it in his hands, he tried to recall who had given it to him, but he had no memory of it. The whistle of the message machine still was calling, and there was work to do. He could not sit here, he told himself, mooning the afternoon away. He put the pyramid of spheres back on the tabletop, and rising, went across the room. The message said, Number 406302 to station 18327. Native of Vega 21 arriving at 16532.82. Departure indeterminate. No luggage. Cabinet only. Local conditions. Confirm. Enoch felt a glow of happiness, looking at the message. It would be good to have a hazer once again. It had been a month or more since one had passed through the station. He could remember back to that first day he had ever met a hazer, when the five of them had come. It must have been, he thought, back in 1914, or maybe 1915. World War I, which everyone then was calling the Great War, was underway, he knew. The hazer would be arriving at about the same time as Ulysses, and the three of them could spend a pleasant evening. It was not too often that two good friends ever visited here at once. He stood a bit aghast at thinking of the hazer as a friend, for more than likely the being itself was one he had never met. But that made little difference, for a hazer, any hazer, would turn out to be a friend. He got the cabinet in position beneath the materializer unit and double-checked to be sure that everything was exactly as it should be, then went back to the message machine and sent off the confirmation. And all the time his memory kept on nagging at him. Had it been 1914, or perhaps a little later? At the catalog cabinet, he pulled out a drawer and found Vega 21, and the first date listed was July 12, 1915. He found the record book on the shelf and pulled it out and brought it to the desk. He leafed through it rapidly until he found the date. Chapter 14. July 12, 1915. Arrived this afternoon, 3:20 p.m., five beings from Vega 21, the first of their kind to pass through this station. They are biped and humanoid, and one gains the impression that they are not made of flesh, that flesh would be too gross for the kinds of things they are, but of course they are made of flesh the same as anyone. They glow, not with a visible light, but there is about them an aura that goes with them wherever they may be. They were, I gathered, a sexual unit, the five of them, although I am not so certain I understand, for it is most confusing. They were happy and friendly, and they carried with them an air of faint amusement, not at anything in particular, but at the universe itself, as if they might have enjoyed some sort of cosmic and very private joke that was known to no one else. They were on a holiday, and were en route to a festival, although that may not be the precise word for it, on another planet, where other life forms were gathering for a week of carnival. Just how they had been invited or why they had been invited I was unable to determine. It must surely have been a great honor for them to be going there, but so far as I could see they did not seem to think so, but took it as their right. They were very happy and without a care and extremely self-assured and poised, but thinking back on it, I would suppose that they are always that way. I found myself just a little envious at not being able to be as carefree and gay as they were, and trying to imagine how fresh life and the universe must seem to them, and a little resentful that they could be, so unthinkingly, as happy as they were. I had, according to instructions, hung hammocks so that they could rest, but they did not use them. They brought with them hampers that were filled with food and drink, and sat down at my table and began to talk and feast. They asked me to sit with them, and they chose two dishes and a bottle, which they assured me would be safe for me to eat and drink, the rest of their fare being somewhat doubtful for a metabolism such as mine. The food was delicious, and of a kind I had never tasted, one dish being rather like the rarest and most delicate of old cheeses, and the other of a sweetness that was heavenly. The drink was somewhat like the faintest of brandies, yellow in color, and no heavier than water. They asked me about myself and about my planet, and they were courteous and seemed genuinely interested, and they were quick of understanding in the things I told them. They told me they were headed for a planet, the name of which I had not heard before, and they talked among themselves, gaily and happily, but in such a way that I did not seem to be left out. From their talk, I gained the fact that some form of art was being presented at the festival on this planet. The art form was not alone of music or painting, but was composed of sound and color and emotion and form and other qualities for which there seemed to be no words in the language of the earth, and which I do not entirely recognize, only gaining the very faintest inkling of what they were talking of in this particular regard. I gained the impression of a three-dimensional symphony, although this is not entirely the right expression, which had been composed not by a single being, but by a team of beings. They talked of the art form enthusiastically, and I seemed to understand that it would last for not only several hours, but for days, and that it was an experience rather than a listening or seeing, and that the spectators or audience did not merely sit and listen, but could, if they wished, and must, to get the most out of it, be participants. But I could not understand how they participated, and felt I should not ask. They talked of the people they would meet, and when they had met them last, and gossiped considerably about them, although in kindly fashion, leaving the impression that they and many other people went from planet to planet for some happy purpose. But whether there was any purpose other than enjoyment in their going, I could not determine. I gathered that there might be. They spoke of other festivals, and not all of them were concerned with the one art form, but with other more specialized aspects of the arts, of which I could gain no adequate idea. They seemed to find a great and exuberant happiness in the festivals, and it seemed to me that some certain significances aside from the art itself contributed to that happiness. I did not join in this part of their conversation, for, frankly, there was no opportunity. I would have liked to ask some questions, but I had no chance. I suppose that if I had, my questions must have sounded stupid to them, but given the chance, that would not have bothered me too much. And yet, in spite of this, they managed somehow to make me feel I was included in their conversation. There was no obvious attempt to do this, and yet they made me feel I was one with them, and not simply a station keeper they would spend a short time with. At times, they spoke briefly in the language of their planet, which is one of the most beautiful I have ever heard. But for the most part, they conversed in the vernacular used by a number of the humanoid races, a sort of pidgin language made up for convenience, and I suspect that this was done out of courtesy to me. And a great courtesy it was. I believed that they were truly the most civilized people I have ever met. I have said they glowed, and I think by that I mean they glowed in spirit. It seemed that they were accompanied somehow by a sparkling golden haze that made happy everything it touched, almost as if they moved in some special world that no one else had found. Sitting at the table with them, I seemed to be included in this golden haze, and I felt strange, quiet, deep currents of happiness flowing in my veins. I wondered by what route they and their world had arrived at this golden state, and if my world could, in some distant time, attain it. But back of this happiness was a great vitality, the bubbling, effervescent spirit with an inner core of strength and a love of living that seemed to fill every pore of them and every instant of their time. They had only 2 hours' time, and it passed so swiftly that I had to finally warn them it was time to go. Before they left, they placed 2 packages on the table and said they were for me and thanked me for my table. What a strange way for them to put it. Then they said goodbye and stepped into the cabinet, extra large one, and I sent them on their way. Even after they were gone, the golden haze seemed to linger in the room, and it was hours before all of it was gone. I wished that I might have gone with them to that other planet and its festival. One of the packages they left contained 12 bottles of the brandy-like liquor, and the bottles themselves were each a piece of art, no 2 of them alike, being formed of what I am convinced is diamond, but whether fabricated diamond or carved from some great stones, I have no idea. At any rate, I would estimate that each of them is priceless, and each carved in a disturbing variety of symbolisms, each of which, however, has a special beauty of its own. And in the other box was a, well, I suppose that, for lack of other name, you might call it a music box. The box itself is ivory, old yellow ivory that is as smooth as satin, and covered by a mass of diagrammatic carving, which must have some significance which I do not understand. On the top of it is a circle set inside a graduated scale, and when I turned the circle to the first graduation, there was music, and through all the room an interplay of many colored light, as if the entire room was filled with different kinds of color. And through it all, a far-off suggestion of that golden haze. And from the box came, too, perfumes that filled the room, and feeling, emotion, whatever one may call it, but something that took hold of one, and made one sad or happy or whatever might go with the music and the color and perfume. Out of that box came a world in which one lived out the composition, or whatever it might be, living it with all that one had in him, all the emotion and belief and intellect of which one is capable. And here, I am quite certain, was a recording of that art form of which they had been talking. And not one composition alone, but 206 of them, for that is the number of the graduation marks, and for each mark there is a separate composition. In the days to come, I shall play them all, and make notes upon each of them, and assign them names, perhaps, according to their characteristics, and from them, perhaps, can gain some knowledge as well as entertainment. Chapter 15. The 12 diamond bottles, empty long ago, stood in a sparkling row upon the fireplace mantel. The music box, as one of his choicest possessions, was stored inside one of the cabinets, where no harm could come to it. And Enoch thought rather ruefully, in all these years, despite regular use of it, he had not as yet played through the entire list of compositions. There were so many of the early ones that begged for a replaying that he was not a great deal more than halfway through the graduated markings. The Hazers had come back, the five of them, time and time again, for it seemed that they found in this station, perhaps even in the man who operated it, some quality that pleased them. They had helped him learn the Vegan language, and had brought him scrolls of Vegan literature, and many other things, and had been, without any doubt, the best friends among the aliens, other than Ulysses, that he had ever had. Then one day they came no more, and he wondered why, asking after them when other Hazers showed up at the station, but he had never learned what had happened to them. He knew far more now about the Hazers and their art forms, their traditions and their customs, and their history, than he'd known that first day he'd written of them back in 1915. But he still was far from grasping many of the concepts that were commonplace with them. There had been many of them since that day in 1915, and there was one he remembered in particular, the old, wise one, the philosopher, who had died on the floor beside the sofa. They had been sitting on the sofa, talking, and he even could remember the subject of their talk. The old one had been telling of the perverse code of ethics, at once irrational and comic, which had been built up by that curious race of social vegetables he had encountered on one of his visits to an off-track planet on the other side of the galactic rim. The old Hazer had a drink or two beneath his belt, and he was in splendid form, relating incident after incident with enthusiastic gusto. Suddenly, in mid-sentence, he had stopped his talking, and had slumped quietly forward. Enoch, startled, reached for him, but before he could lay a hand upon him, the old alien had slid slowly to the floor. The golden haze had faded from his body, and slowly flickered out, and the body lay there, angular and bony and obscene. A terribly alien thing there upon the floor, a thing that was at once pitiful and monstrous. More monstrous, it seemed to Enoch, than anything in alien form he had ever seen before. In life, it had been a wondrous creature, but now, in death, it was an old bag of hideous bones with a scaly parchment stretched to hold the bones together. It was the golden haze, Enoch told himself, gulping, in something near to horror, that had made the Hazer seem so wondrous and so beautiful, so vital, so alive and quick, so filled with dignity. The golden haze was the life of them, and when the haze was gone, they became mere repulsive horrors that one gagged to look upon. Could it be, he wondered, that the goldenness was the Hazer's life force, and that they wore it like a cloak, as a sort of overall disguise? Did they wear their life force on the outside of them, while all other creatures wore it on the inside? A piteous little wind was lamenting in the gingerbread high up in the gables, and through the windows he could see battalions of tattered clouds fleeing in ragged retreat across the moon, which had climbed halfway up the eastern sky. There was a coldness and a loneliness in the station, a far-reaching loneliness that stretched out and out, farther than mere earth loneliness could go. Enoch turned from the body and walked stiffly across the room to the message machine. He put in a call for a connection direct with Galactic Central, then stood waiting, gripping the sides of the machine with both his hands. "Go ahead," said Galactic Central. Briefly, as objectively as he was able, Enoch reported what had happened. There was no hesitation, and there were no questions from the other end, just the simple directions, as if this was something that happened all the time, of how the situation should be handled. The Vegan must remain upon the planet of his death, its body to be disposed of according to the local customs obtaining on that planet. For that was the Vegan law, and likewise a point of honor. A Vegan, when he fell, must stay where he fell, and that place became, forever, a part of Vega 21. There were such places, said Galactic Central, all through the galaxy. "The custom here," typed Enoch, "is to inter the dead." "Then inter the Vegan. We read a verse or two from our holy book."
"Read one for the Vegan, then. You can do all this?"
"Yes, but we usually have it done by a practitioner of religion. Under the present circumstances, however, that might be unwise."
"Agreed," said Galactic Central. "You can do as well yourself?"
"I can."
"It is best, then, that you do."
"Will there be relatives or friends arriving for the rites?"
"No."
"You will notify them?"
"Formally, of course. But they already know."
"He only died a moment or two ago."
"Nevertheless, they know."
"What about a death certificate?"
"None is needed. They know of what he died."
"His luggage? There is a trunk."
"Keep it. It is yours. It is a token for the services you perform for the honored dead. That also is the law."
"But there may be important matters in it."
"You will keep the trunk. To refuse would insult the memory of the dead."
"Anything else?" asked Enoch.
"That is all?"
"That is all.
Proceed as if the Vegan were one of your own."
Enoch cleared the machine and went back across the room. He stood above the hazer, getting up his nerve to bend and lift the body to place it on the sofa. He shrank from touching it. It was so unclean and terrible, such a travesty on the shining creature that had sat there talking with him. Since he met the hazers, he had loved them and admired them and looked forward to each visit by them, by any one of them. And now he stood, a shivering coward who could not touch one dead. It was not the horror only, for in his years as keeper of the station, he had seen much of pure visual horror as portrayed in alien bodies, and yet he had learned to submerge that sense of horror, to disregard the outward appearance of it, to regard all life as brother life, to meet all things as people. It was something else, he knew, some other unknown factor quite apart from horror that he felt. And yet this thing, he reminded himself, was a friend of his. And as a dead friend, it demanded honor from him. It demanded love and care. Blindly, he drove himself to the task. He stooped and lifted it. It had almost no weight at all, as if in death it had lost a dimension of itself, had somehow become a smaller thing and less significant. Could it be, he wondered, that the golden haze might have a weight all of its own? He laid the body on the sofa and straightened it as best he could. Then he went outside and, lighting the lantern in the shed, went down to the barn. It had been years since he had been there, but nothing much had changed. Protected by a tight roof from the weather, it had stayed snug and dry. There were cobwebs hanging from the beams, and dust was everywhere. Straggling clumps of ancient hay, stored in the mow above, hung down through the cracks in the boards that floored the mow. The place had a dry, sweet, dusty smell about it, all the odors of animals and manure long gone. Enoch hung the lantern on the peg behind the row of stanchions, and climbed the ladder to the mow. Working in the dark, for he dared not bring the lantern into this dust heap of dried-out hay, he found the pile of oaken boards far beneath the eaves. Here, he remembered, underneath these slanting eaves, had been a pretended cave in which, as a boy, he had spent many happy rainy days when he could not be outdoors.
He had been Robinson Crusoe in his desert island cave, or some now nameless outlaw hiding from a posse, or a man holed up against the threat of scalp-hunting Indians. He had had a gun, a wooden gun that he had sawed out of a board, working it down later with draw shave and knife and a piece of glass to scrape it smooth. It had been something he had cherished through all his boyhood days, until that day, when he had been 12, that his father, returning home from a trip to town, had handed him a rifle for his very own. He explored the stack of boards in the dark, determining by the feel the ones that he would need. These he carried to the ladder and carefully slid down to the floor below. Climbing down the ladder, he went up the short flight of stairs to the granary, where the tools were stored. He opened the lid of the great tool chest and found that it was filled with long-deserted mice nests. Pulling out handfuls of the straw and hay and grass that the rodents had used to set up their one-time housekeeping, he uncovered the tools. The shine had gone from them, their surface grayed by the soft patina that came from long disuse, but there was no rust upon them, and the cutting edges still retained their sharpness. Selecting the tools he needed, he went back to the lower part of the barn and fell to work. A century ago, he thought, he had done as he was doing now, working by lantern light to construct a coffin, and that time it had been his father lying in the house. The oaken boards were dry and hard, but the tools still were in shape to handle them. He sawed and planed and hammered, and there was the smell of sawdust. The barn was snug and silent, the depth of hay standing in the mow drowning out the noise of the complaining wind outside. He finished the coffin, and it was heavier than he had figured, so he found the old wheelbarrow, leaning against the wall back of the stalls that once had been used for horses, and loaded the coffin on it. Laboriously, stopping often to rest, he wheeled it down to the little cemetery inside the apple orchard. And here, beside his father's grave, he dug another grave, having brought a shovel and a pickaxe with him. He did not dig it as deep as he would have liked to dig, not the full 6 feet that was decreed by custom, for he knew that if he dug it that deep he never would be able to get the coffin in. So he dug it slightly less than 4, laboring in the light of the lantern, set atop the mound of dirt to cast its feeble glow. An owl came up from the woods and sat for a while, unseen, somewhere in the orchard, muttering and gurgling in between its hoots. The moon sank toward the west, and the ragged clouds thinned out to let the stars shine through. Finally, it was finished. With the grave completed, and the casket in the grave, and the lantern flickering, the kerosene almost gone, and the chimney blacked from the angle at which the lantern had been canted. Back at the station, Enoch hunted up a sheet in which to wrap the body. He put a Bible in his pocket and picked up the shrouded Vagan, and, in the first faint light that preceded dawn, marched down to the apple orchard. He put the Vagan in the coffin and nailed shut the lid, then climbed from the grave. Standing on the edge of it, he took the Bible from his pocket and found the place he wanted. He read aloud, scarcely needing to strain his eyes in the dim light to follow the text, for it was from a chapter that he had read many times. "In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you." Thinking, as he read it, how appropriate it was, how there must need be many mansions in which to house all the souls in the galaxy, and of all the other galaxies that stretched, perhaps interminably, through space. Although, if there were understanding, one might be enough. He finished reading and recited the burial service, from memory, as best he could, not being absolutely sure of all the words, but sure enough, he told himself, to make sense out of it. Then he shoveled in the dirt. The stars and moon were gone, and the wind had died. In the quietness of the morning, the eastern sky was pearly pink. Enoch stood beside the grave, with the shovel in his hand. "Goodbye, my friend," he said. Then he turned, and, in the first flush of the morning, went back to the station. Chapter 16 Enoch got up from his desk and carried the record book back to the shelf and slid it into place. He turned around and stood hesitantly. There were things that he should do. He should read his papers. He should be writing up his journal. There were a couple of papers in the latest issues of the Journal of Geophysical Research that he should be looking at. But he didn't feel like doing any of them. There was too much to think about, too much to worry over, too much to mourn. The Watchers still were out there. He had lost his shadow people, and the world was edging in toward war. Although, perhaps, he should not be worrying about what happened to the world. He could renounce the world, could resign from the human race any time he wished. If he never went outside, if he never opened up the door, then it would make no difference to him what the world might do or what might happen to it. For he had a world. He had a greater world than anyone outside this station had ever dreamed about. He did not need the Earth. But even as he thought it, he knew he could not make it stick. For in a very strange and funny way, he still did need the Earth. He walked over to the door and spoke the phrase, and the door came open. He walked into the shed, and it closed behind him. He went around the corner of the house and sat down on the steps that led up to the porch. This, he thought, was where it all had started. He had been sitting here that summer day of long ago when the stars had reached out across vast gulfs of space and put the finger on him. The sun was far down the sky toward the west, and soon it would be evening. Already the heat of the day was falling off, with a faint, cool breeze creeping up out of the hollow that ran down to the river valley. Down across the field, at the edge of the woods, crows were wheeling in the sky and cawing. It would be hard to shut the door, he knew, and keep it shut. Hard never to feel the sun or wind again, to never know the smell of the changing seasons as they came across the earth. Man, he told himself, was not ready for that. He had not as yet become so totally a creature of his own created environment that he could divorce entirely the physical characteristics of his native planet. He needed sun and soil and wind to remain a man. He should do this oftener, Enoch thought. Come out here and sit, doing nothing, just looking. Seeing the trees and the river to the west, and the blue of the Iowa hills across the Mississippi, watching the crows wheeling in the skies, and the pigeons strutting on the ridgepole of the barn. It would be worthwhile each day to do it, for what was another hour of aging? He did not need to save his hours. Not now, he didn't. There might come a time when he'd become very jealous of them, and when that day came, he could hoard the hours and minutes, even the seconds, in as miserly a fashion as he could manage. He heard the sound of the running feet as they came around the farther corner of the house. A stumbling, exhausted running, as if the one who ran might have come a far way. He leapt to his feet and strode out into the yard to see who it might be, and the runner came stumbling toward him with her arms outstretched. He put out an arm and caught her as she came close to him, holding her close against him so she would not fall. "Lucy!" he cried. "Lucy, what has happened, child?" His hands against her back were warm and sticky, and he took one of them away to see that it was smeared with blood. The back of her dress, he saw, was soaked and dark. He grabbed her by the shoulders and shoved her away from him so he could see her face. It was wet with crying, and there was terror in the face, and pleading with the terror. She pulled away from him and turned around. Her hands came up and slipped her dress off her shoulders and let it slide halfway down her back. The flesh of the shoulders were ribboned by long slashes that still were oozing blood. She pulled the dress up again and turned to face him. She made a pleading gesture and pointed backward down the hill in the direction of the field that ran down to the woods. There was motion down there, something coming through the woods, almost at the edge of the old deserted field. She must have seen it too, for she came close against him, shivering, seeking his protection. He bent and lifted her in his arms and ran for the shed. He spoke the phrase, and the door came open, and he stepped into the station. Behind him he heard the door go sliding shut. Once inside, he stood there, with Lucy Fisher cradled in his arms, and knew that what he'd done had been a great mistake, that it was something that, in a sober moment, he never would have done, that if he'd given it a second thought, he would not have done it. But he had acted on an impulse, with no thought at all. The girl had asked protection, and here she had protection. Here, nothing in the world ever could get at her. But she was a human being, and no human being other than himself should have ever crossed the threshold. But it was done, and there was no way to change it. Once across the threshold, there was no way to change it. He carried her across the room and put her on the sofa, then stepped back. She sat there, looking up at him, smiling very faintly, as if she did not know if she were allowed to smile in a place like this. She lifted a hand and tried to brush away the tears that were upon her cheeks. She looked quickly around the room, and her mouth made an O of wonder. He squatted down and patted the sofa and shook a finger at her, hoping that she might understand that he meant she should stay there, that she must go nowhere else. He swept an arm in a motion to take in all the remainder of the station and shook his head as sternly as he could. She watched him, fascinated. Then she smiled and nodded, as if she might have understood. He reached out and took one of her hands in his own, and holding it, patted it as gently as he could, trying to reassure her, to make her understand that everything was all right if she only stayed exactly where she was. She was smiling now, not wondering, apparently, if there were any reason that she should not smile. She reached out her free hand and made a little fluttering gesture toward the coffee table with its load of alien gadgets. He nodded, and she picked up one of them, turning it admiringly in her hand. He got to his feet and went to the wall to take down the rifle. Then he went outside to face whatever had been pursuing her. Chapter 17. Two men were coming up the field toward the house, and Enoch saw that one of them was Hank Fisher, Lucy's father. He had met the man, rather briefly, several years ago, on one of his walks. Hank had explained, rather sheepishly and when no explanation had been necessary, that he was hunting for a cow which had strayed away. But from his furtive manner, Enoch had deduced that his errand, rather than the hunting of a cow, had been somewhat on the shady side, although he could not imagine what it might have been. The other man was younger, no more perhaps than 16 or 17. More than likely, Enoch told himself, he was one of Lucy's brothers. Enoch stood by the porch and waited. Hank, he saw, was carrying a coiled whip in his hand, and looking at it, Enoch understood those wounds on Lucy's shoulders. He felt a swift flash of anger, but tried to fight it down. He could deal better with Hank Fisher if he kept his temper. The two men stopped 3 paces or so away. "Good afternoon," said Enoch. "You seen my gal?" asked Hank.
"And if I have?" asked Enoch.
"I'll take the hide off of her," yelled Hank, flourishing the whip.
"In such a case," said Enoch, "I don't believe I'll tell you anything."
"You got her hid," charged Hank.
"You can look around," said Enoch.
Hank took a quick step forward, then thought better of it.
"She got what she had coming to her," he yelled, "and I ain't finished with her yet. There ain't no one, not even my own flesh and blood, can put a hex on me."
Enoch said nothing. Hank stood, undecided.
"She meddled," he said. "She had no call to meddle. It was none of her damn business."
The young man said, "I was just trying to train Butcher." "Butcher," he explained to Enoch, "is a coonhound pup."
"That is right," said Hank. "He wasn't doing nothing wrong. The boys caught a young coon the other night. Took a lot of doing. Roy here had staked out the coon, tied it to a tree, and he had Butcher on a leash. He was letting Butcher fight the coon, not hurting anything. He'd pull Butcher off before any damage could be done and let them rest a while. Then he let Butcher at the coon again."
"It's the best way in the world," said Roy,
"to get a coon dog trained." "That is right," said Hank. "That is why they caught the coon."
"We needed it," said Roy, "to train this Butcher pup."
"This all is fine," said Enoch, "and I am glad to hear it. But what has it got to do with Lucy?"
"She interfered," said Hank. "She tried to stop the training. She tried to grab Butcher away from Roy here."
"For a dummy," Roy said, "she is a mite too uppity.
You hush your mouth, his father told him sternly, swinging around on him.
Roy mumbled to himself, falling back a step. Hank turned back to Enoch.
Roy knocked her down, he said. He shouldn't have done that. He should have been more careful.
I didn't mean to, Roy said. I just swung my arm out to keep her away from Butcher.
That is right, said Hank. He swung a bit too hard, but there wasn't any call for her doing what she did. She tied Butcher up in knots so he couldn't fight that coon. Without laying a finger on him, mind you, she tied him up in knots. He couldn't move a muscle. That made Roy mad. He appealed to Enoch earnestly. Wouldn't that have made you mad?
I don't think it would, said Enoch. But then, I'm not a coon dog man. Hank stared in wonder at this lack of understanding. But he went on with his story.
Roy got real mad at her. He'd raised that butcher. He thought a lot of him. He wasn't going to let no one, not even his own sister, tie that dog in knots. So he went after her, and she tied him up in knots, just like she did to Butcher. I never seen a thing like it in all my born days. Roy just stiffened up, and then he fell down to the ground, and his legs pulled up against his belly, and he wrapped his arms around himself, and he laid there on the ground, pulled into a ball. Him and Butcher both. But she never touched that coon. She never tied him in no knots. Her own folks is all she touched.
It didn't hurt, said Roy. It didn't hurt at all.
I was sitting there, said Hank, braiding this here bullwhip. Its end had frayed, and I fixed a new one on it, and I seen it all. But I didn't do a thing until I saw Roy there tied up on the ground, and I figured then it had gone far enough. I am a broad-minded man. I don't mind a little wart-charming and other piddling things like that. There have been a lot of people who have been able to do that. It ain't no disgrace at all. But this thing of tying dogs and people into knots...
So you hit her with the whip, said Enoch.
I did my duty, Hank told him solemnly. I ain't about to have no witch in any family of mine.